I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. The rioters who attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6 were inspired by the conspiracy theory perpetrated by then-President Trump and his allies that the presidential election had been stolen. A sizable portion of the Republican Party still believes this lie, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, including numerous court rulings, testimony by government officials, evidence presented by the January 6 House Committee. This is just one of many conspiracy theories circulating today. Others include allegations that Democrats operated a pedophile sex trafficking ring in the basement of a D.C. pizza parlor, that COVID-19 is a fake virus, that lizard people are taking over the planet, the victims of mass shootings are really crisis actors, that Barack Obama was not born in the United States. I could go on. Today on Radio Times, what is the appeal of conspiracy theories? Who is more likely to believe them? What is the role of the media, including social media, in disseminating conspiracy theories? Are facts an effective way to debunk these beliefs? Are conspiracies harmless beliefs, or do they hurt the country? Much to talk about. And we have three guests who have joined us. Two in our Philadelphia studio. Dolores Albarracin is director of the science of the Science Communication Division of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, director of the Social Action Lab at the University of Pennsylvania, co-author of a new book called Creating Conspiracy Beliefs, How Our Thoughts Are Shaped. Dolores Albarracin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Hilde Vandenbulk, and she's a professor of communication at Drexel University. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. And joining us remotely is Kathleen Hall Jamison. She's director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, co-founder of factcheck.org, and one of the authors of this book we'll be talking about, Creating Conspiracy Beliefs. How Our Thoughts Are Shaped. Kathleen Hall Jamison, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
In fact, let me begin with you, if I could, Kathleen Hall Jamison. Why are conspiracy theories flourishing in the United States today?
The conspiracy theories feed on anxieties in times of uncertainties, and they provide certainty. And in providing that certainty, they help people feel comfortable about their world. They also give us something to blame, someone to blame, and they give us a sense that we're feeling pretty powerful because we know things other people don't know.
So all those things put together, do you think, Hilde, that there's something uniquely American about our conspiracy beliefs?
Well, I think surveys, international surveys, show that on average in America, more people are inclined to believe conspiracies than in other countries. But I think across the globe, we've seen the wave of anti-vax and things like that. I think in countries maybe where more deeply ingrained is more a distrust of the government or you know, a preference to work more outside of the government, you might see it more often because many of these really behind the surface message they have go very much back to a distrust in, you know, the states and the main powers that be.
And that seems like a very kind of American belief system about mistrusting government.
Yeah.
Compared to other countries.
Maybe. Yes, I think so.
Dolores, let me go to you, and just to underscore what both Kathleen and Hilde have been saying, because when you look at the last couple of years, there's been political turmoil. There's been the pandemic. We've got the climate crisis. I mean, there's a long list of what feels like imminent danger crises afoot. Do you think that has helped to create this environment?
It contributes, but it's certainly not sufficient in any way. The primary motivator is social influence. These are beliefs we share. It's not my individual delusion about my neighbor or, you know, my boss or something that's unique to me. These beliefs are shared. So they are actually transmitted through interactions with others, and also through the formal exposure to media contents that actually promote these beliefs.
So the power of media to sort of fan these beliefs.
Media for sure, also other interactions and formal interactions within your networks in real life. And I'm here, and I'm not saying that it's social media because there's actually no real good evidence of that, but it's socially shared and therefore communicated to us, exchanged through many interactions with family members, neighbors, etc., in addition to media exposure, of course.
Hilde, you're nodding your head. Looks like you want to add something, and then Kathleen, I'll get you back in.
Yes, I agree that it's very much a sort of shared thinking about things. There's certain people like Alex Jones that we, you know, we're all focusing on now, who is maybe a real instigator and a propagator, right? My co-author, who studies it from a propaganda perspective, will say it's sort of a propagandizing of a particular message, which goes by endless repetition. Stop the steal, or other things, and that get repeated and that more and more people share. And underneath it is maybe that bigger ideology that many people can then tap into. And then, as my colleague here says, right, they communicate with each other. It gets amplified through media, repeated through media. And so it's a whole process.
But the important is the repeating, the over and over saying of whatever.
Yes. Yes, that is a very important one, because that sort of starts to set in your mind and helps to sort of reshape your thinking about it. It's like a paradigm shift in your head almost, right? At some point, and then there's a tipping point maybe where you feel that, yes, suddenly things seem to click into place in a different story than the story that you used to hear. And then you're hooked on that story, and that's a conspiracy.
Well, Kathleen, let me go back to you, and I'm thinking of this thing called confirmation bias, which is we tend to seek out information that kind of reinforces what we believe anyway. Does that play a role in conspiracy beliefs?
Yes, and the likelihood, as Dolores was indicating, that we are within media channels that are providing reinforcement is as a result higher as we seek out forms of media that reinforce our existing predispositions. But there's another factor at play. There are some individuals who are just simply more disposed to see the world through a lens that says nothing happens by chance. And so they're looking for an explanation for something. Now, they put in place a second presupposition, and there are malign actors who exercise power in ways that aren't readily apparent. You put those two things together, nothing happens by chance. There are malign actors who are exercising powers in ways that we can't actually see because they're engaged in all sorts of secret intrigue. And now someone says, I'll strip back that veil and I'll show you how the secret manipulation is happening and who is actually doing it. And I'm going to account for something that you're having some trouble explaining because it's scary, it's new. For example, monkeypox just appears.
Yes.
Well, what's the explanation? Now, nothing happens by chance, and also no real understanding that there are viruses out there all the time. We're in constant touch with nature in new ways because we're pushing into places in which nature and humans weren't interacting in the same ways, more likely contact for it with a virus that could jump from one place to another, from one species to another, hence to us. No thought that might be natural. It must be 5G that's done it. And now we take a third factor, the assumption that associations equal causation. So, we had the vaccine first, widespread vaccination. Here comes monkeypox. Vaccine must have caused it. Or 5G activated our COVID vaccines, which caused it. Now you're starting to get a complex explanation, and under that are some fears, including in the case of 5G, fear of a new technology. In the case of concern about the malign actors, fear of those who exercise power and as a result might exercise it in a way that does social harm.
That's a lot. And I understand how those pieces fit together. And it's very instructive. Dolores, if I can go back to you, because I know you and your co-authors looked at media, broadly speaking, but it seemed as if people who ingest or follow a lot of conservative media seem to be primed for some of these beliefs. Help us understand that.
Yes, I think one aspect that sort of requires attention is that this is happening in part because it's a circular system of thought from which you cannot get out. If you try to get out, it's explained within the system. So we take him to court, and, well, now he's a victim of the same perpetrators.
He We're was talking about Alex Jones before. There. Yes,
so
right.
How do you deal with this? And that is a fundamental problem, that you cannot disconfirm it within being in the system. So having said that, there are a couple of factors. One is social influence. That's a primary one. Actually, personality plays a very, very minimal role, if any. It's social influence, but what does matter sometimes, it's the anxiety you experience in the moment. So that means worries I might have, you know, subtle fears. And we all live with that. And we are sort of programmed to cope with that by creating beliefs, imagining possibilities. And this is the main predisposition factor. What also happens is that the media can also inject anxiety in the population. And of course, the conservative media, you don't have to look too far to see how that could be true in some cases. For other topics, they minimize, of course. But in our studies, we do find that anxiety actually exacerbates the impact of the content from the media, but media exposure also heightens anxiety. So you have this sort of magic combination or lethal combination that actually exacerbates these beliefs.
And again, you're nodding your head, Hildy, but it's interesting to think about then, broadly speaking, conservative media. I think Alex Jones is a perfect example of just feeding people's fears.
Yes, and I think it's kind of interesting maybe in that sense that when, for instance, Fox Channel finally started to broadcast the January 6th hearings, that the first time they broadcasted it, they lost more than 500,000 viewers because that contradicts everything else that has been said and repeated to them and what, you know, the people who listen to it have built their own little sort of world of beliefs. And that was such, and so people, I think it's kind of removing yourself from not wanting to hear maybe things that then contradict, right? After you've been spending so much time in and being invested in conspiracies or in very particular kind of thoughts. And I think certainly the media can be very good instruments. Certainly in the case of Alex Jones, he really knows how to use media, if you like. He goes on very long rants in his own programs, but then while he was still on social media, knows kind of the art to cut it up in little YouTube and whatever things, making it sort of ready for meme culture. He was at some point very proud. That was the most memed person. Because all that serves his purpose of getting his sort of message out there.
We're almost having a break, and Hildy, if I can go back to you, but do you think that that anyone is susceptible to this, or are there certain sort of personality traits besides fear and anxiety?
Well, I think in essence probably everybody is, but like my colleague here says, I think that, you know, heightened anxiety can happen to anyone, right? The most serious people, the most educated people, the most, you know, whatever people, anxiety can help. And one of the things that it does is maybe that if you're feeling very low or whatever, you do not understand what's going on, it also a form of empowerment to sort of know, if you look at people who sort of slowly move towards conspiracies, you often see indeed that they are in a moment maybe where there's a lot of anxiety going on in their life, and then if you sort of see them develop, you see them finding a new strength in, and sometimes almost becoming little propagandists, maybe also spreading that message, like with anti-vax, we've seen several of those, and it gives them a sort of a power. So I think in that sense, because it's not just about the actual thing that they believe in, I think that plays a role in how anybody could be susceptible.
Probably. Well, we are talking about conspiracies, conspiracy beliefs today on Radio Times. And you can join our conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with our guests about why people believe conspiracy theories. We're talking about the appeal, the rise, the spread of conspiracy theories today. And we'll be talking about how to confront them. And our guests are Dolores Albarracin and Kathleen Hall Jamison, who have co-authored, along with some other authors, a new book called Creating Conspiracy Beliefs, subtitled How Our Thoughts Are Shaped. Also with us, Hildy Vandenbulk, and she's a professor of communication at Drexel University. We got a lot of calls and comments here that I do want to get to. Kathleen Hall Jamison, let me turn to you, though. I wonder whether complicating in understanding conspiracy beliefs is the government does lie. You know, I mean, that there are people in power who have lied to us and will lie to us. So in trying to sort of understand this complicated world, we have to sift through information that we think is true, that might not be true, that maybe we learn later isn't true. How does that create this environment for conspiracy theories?
Well, first, it means that when we say conspiracy theory, we shouldn't make the assumption that simply by calling it a conspiracy theory, we're making a claim about whether it's true or false. There have been conspiracy theories that were proven to be true. Arms were traded for hostages. You know, Iran-Contra was a conspiracy theory until, that is, people assumed it was false, until it was proven true. Watergate was a conspiracy. It was a conspiracy theory. It was actually found to be true. There was collusion and conspiracy involved in Watergate. So as you point out, because powerful entities do cover up, they do lie, and because we don't want a populace that engages in naive and unconditional trust of those in power, the question is, how do you balance justified skepticism against what is a reasonable perception of what we can know in the moment about what's plausible and implausible? And so when we say that something is conspiracy theory that we presume is unwarranted, what we mean is that when someone has looked at all of the available evidence, the kinds of things that a reasonable person would expect to constitute proof of something are absent. And this is largely as a result based on inferences based on presuppositions about secrecy and malign agents, not on evidence of actual secrecy or malign agentry.
I mean, it sounds like you have to be very rational. That's pretty hard, isn't it?
Well, I have one. When we talk about conspiracy theories that ultimately are being perpetuated and unwarranted, it's always important to say one thing. When you get these moments in which someone is covering something up and we found it out, so notice I cited Iran-Contra, I cited Watergate, the journalistic establishment is often the establishment through its investigative techniques that uncovers and documents for us. And so what we need to say is when someone says, for example, Sandy Hook, the people involved in Sandy Hook are simply crisis actors and no one was killed there, you know, how do we know that that actually occurred? Well, first, we actually know it occurred because we have documentary evidence of it. We have testimony of it. We have pictures of it, et cetera, et cetera. But when you're talking about a conspiracy in which nobody can see any of those things, it's all happening behind the scenes, when that's uncovered, the likelihood it's going to be uncovered is through traditional journalistic techniques. There are ways of knowing that ultimately do unravel these things. And as a result, when one says, should you trust Alex Jones or should you trust the reporter for the best newspaper you read or the best news outlet, my conclusion is I'm going to trust the best outlet. And if that person says that Alex Jones is wrong, if I have no other evidence of anything, I'm going to trust journalists over Alex Jones because the journalists have been right a lot more times than Alex Jones is. I believe at this point the score for Alex Jones would be zero.
Well, I would agree with you, but I feel like, and I'm looking at you, Dolores, though, and to you, Hildy, as well, is it those people that believe Alex Jones and tune in faithfully and hang on his every word are going to believe Alex Jones.
Right, and they live in a parallel reality of sorts in which the mainstream media are the fakers. So
exactly.
Then it all makes sense, and they have a very legit source of information that tells them what's really, really going on. And you know, that's essentially what's happening. So,
well, and Hilda, it's funny. We had some Alex Jones clips, and we were, do we play them? Do we not play them? And I think the question is sort of how do you talk about this stuff without feeding the conspiracy theorists, the peddlers, and also the believers?
Yeah, because I think one of the things is that, as you also say, right, there is a rationality. It's just a very different rationality. They have their own sort of rationality. And like, you know, like the fact that, as we earlier said, the fact that Jones is in court kind of proves these peoples that there is a conspiracy of the big powers against them.
And
this is also the thing that
he
says all the time, right? That they, all these things are, so it's very hard. So I do think that if you do talk about it, it's very important to give the right kind of context and to give as many facts as possible. And I think in that sense, a sort of the role of maybe media to sort of help with the fact-checking almost, right? And sort of, I know that in certain European public broadcasters, for instance, a couple of years ago, they have started literally having journalists coming in and fact-checked whatever political claims are made during campaigns, right? To just really help see through the sort of the rhetoric and see what are the facts. The issue there is, of course, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Is also that, because is it because they don't believe in facts or don't believe in science? If you, for instance, look at a very different kind of conspiracy like Flat Earth, right, which I always found very hard to figure out
Why believe in that?
Why,
right?
Is my life better if I think that the Earth is flat? Again, some of it goes back, don't trust NASA, don't trust big institutions. Some seems to have some religious connection, right? But they do their own science, but which is what the eye can see. So YouTube is full of little movies of showing that if you look far enough in the Bay of San Francisco, there's no curb at the end, so the Earth must be flat.
Yeah.
So there is, or QAnon, that invites people to do their own research, right? So I think it's very difficult to say what then, because they say that science, or we talk about as science probably, is just another opinion.
Well, talking to the person who's the director of the science of the science of communication, but how important is it to fact check, and to fact check in real time, to fact check where the conspiracy theories are living and being disseminated?
It's of course important, and we, you know, the population is entitled to the truth, and we need the mechanisms to make sure that comes out. And at the same time, for this to really be reversed, you need a much earlier intervention through the K-12 system. By the time people, you know, are adults, fully formed adults who distrust all plausible media and science and so on, how do you fix that? It's not fixed with a fact check. So it's both. It's checking in the moment, the sort of newer incarnations of these variety of theories, but at the same time ensuring that you are actually getting the right trust in the right institutions from the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
and training people in a scientific mindset that allows them to say, you know what, that cannot make sense. It does not make sense. And under any sort of regulations or laws of the world as I know it. And that's what's missing to some extent. And of course, education level does correlate with adherence to these. It's not an absolute relationship, but you know, there is a certain level of association that lower education makes you vulnerable.
Interesting. Well, let me go to the co-founder of factcheck.org, to you, Kathleen Hall Jamieson. In this sort of battle, if I can put it that way, the battle between facts and falseness or conspiracy theories, how do you win in that battle?
Well, first, you would have to have a theory of change that says who is able to change, who is likely to change, and then how are you going to get the message to those who are going to be susceptible to it. If someone's already deeply enmeshed in a conspiracy theory about the world, if they have a conspiracy mindset about it, if they're attending to media channels that reinforce it, and if they've integrated into their sense of personal identity, no amount of external intervention short of an intense psychological process by which you capture them and control their environment for an extended period of time, hopefully with their consent, is likely to have any effect. But what the theory that we have of how the fact-checking process works is you've got a whole lot of people who aren't there. They might go there, however, if they're not given the best available understanding of the world that we can put together through the methods that we have with an explanation of how you know. So Sally Chan and Dolores and a number of other co-authors did a meta-analysis that looked at corrective effect. And the reality is it's very difficult to correct once somebody's holding a belief that's grounded in their experience of the world and has reinforcing under it. However, you can displace some things that people believe. So, for example, if someone has accepted information based on a false cause and you have a compelling case that there is an accurate cause, you have some capacity, even if they've accepted the false cause, to displace that by saying, yes, you might think that based on this and this, but let's look at what actually happened based on what else we know. So there's some moves that give you an alternative construction that can have some effect. But we think at factcheck.org, and the theory underlying it is, that the best thing we can do is provide the protection that comes from putting the available knowledge out before people have moved too far into accepting all of those things that are the building blocks to get them into a specific conspiracy. And that means understanding how the system works and the protections the system has in place to blunt the misuses or potential misuses of power. So how do we know that the vaccine process does not involve a vast amount of cover-up? because we've got all sorts of independent stages of review attached to it by people who have a self-interest. That is, it's their venal self-interest to expose anything that's untoward, because then they're going to build their reputations as a result. And so an independent review process is one of our safeguards. Disclosure of any potential relational conflicts of interest is another, so that you can see any places someone might be biased. And as a result, because of those disclosure requirements, I can tell you that when the conspiracy world says that Anthony Fauci is the single person making all the decisions about vaccination, here are all the reasons I can show you that's untrue.
Hmm.
When you say he's the one who funds all of this, and as a result, he can engage in all these Machiavellian moves, and he was the past president of Moderna, I can show you, based on external documents that we should all grant are legitimate if we're not far into conspiracy world, that that's not true either. So as people start to try to build the conspiracy structure around these false, you know, statements about how the federal vaccine process was corrupted at Anthony Fauci's behest, if I can build all that factual structure in place and that understanding, I may minimize the likelihood that some people fall into the conspiracy world to begin with.
That is Kathleen Hall Jamieson. Also with us, Hilde Vandenbulk and Dolores Albarracin, and we are talking about conspiracy theories. I do want to go back to the trial this week of Alex Jones and play a clip. This is Scarlett Lewis. Her son, Jesse, was murdered in the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting. This is a shooting that Alex Jones has called a hoax. He called the children and their parents crisis actors. He is on trial for defamation. They're trying to figure out just how much money, frankly, this defamation is going to be worth to these parents. But let's listen to what she says, and she's directly confronting Alex Jones in the courtroom.
There's records of Jesse's birth, of me. I mean, I have a history, and there's nothing that you could have found, because it doesn't exist that I'm deep state. It's just not true. I know you know that. That's the problem. I know you know that. And you keep saying it. You keep saying it. Why? Why? For money? Because you've made a lot of money while you've said it. I know you're... I mean... I know you believe me. And yet you're going to leave this courthouse and you're going to say it again on your show.
It is so heartbreaking. I mean, just so heartbreaking to hear those parents and that mother in particular. And I wonder, Hilde, if I could go to you. I mean, this is this personal face-to-face appeal in a courtroom.
Yes. It took 10 years to get to that point.
Yes.
Which in itself is very upsetting to all things. And I think some of it is, this is a moment he has also finally sort of kind of admitted that he now thinks that it is real. I think what he does is he sees the deep state everywhere. And I think almost sort of whatever happens, he will have a deep state conspiracy style explanation for it. Many of these things come and go and he moves on and, you know, the frogs are going to get gay and, the whole range. Here was something that was very real, also in its very personal, and that I think, you know, thanks to the bravery, I think, of these parents and not letting go of saying we want the truth out because this is just too horrible. What these people have been through, also because of all the other people who believe the conspiracy rather than the reality. And I think it has been very personalized, which is, you could say, dramatization. But in this sense, this is real. Also, these people are real. These parents are real. And that's kind of a form of fact-checking that is sort of, it doesn't really get not more real than in this situation. But this is 10 years of these people having to do that. And I would then think, why are there no other systems in place? Why do these people have to go through this for 10 years? Why are there no better systems in place to make sure that we don't have to go this route to finally get to this moment?
And let me just add that Alex Jones has made millions and millions and millions of dollars peddling these conspiracy theories and then also selling you know, pills and yes. survivalist kits and all of that. So there's a lot of money to be made in
there's
this.
There's a lot of money to be made. There's a lot of money to be made in all the social media where he's no longer welcome, but there's still a lot of money to be made in many other aspects. His whole sidelines, indeed, of sort of snake holes, to be honest, right, that nicely fit in with the whole, because it's all about shields to protect your brain or whatever. It all mm-hmm. nicely fits in.
Yeah, the kind of fear, anxiety, Dolores, that we were talking about.
Yes, I think the appeal is brilliant because it really gets at the emotions underlying all of this. And it's replacing anger, which is the emotion he provokes, right? There's a threat out there. We're being, cheated by all these powerful forces. And this is replacing this with very deep sadness of this family and that situation. And that could actually work.
By work, you mean sort of penetrate this,
yes,
this wall?
Yes, I think it could actually change the minds of some previous believers in this by getting them to connect with the reality, emotional reality of these parents. And I think that is really effective.
Yeah.
Much more effective than any other counter we might try to use.
Kathy, about a minute before our break here, do you agree with that? That this emotional appeal and direct appeal in the courtroom helps to debunk some of this conspiracy?
Yes, and I think there's one more facet. Alex Jones traffics in the assumption that you, my audience, are being conned and I'm exposing the con and showing you how to protect yourself. The clips from this trial are showing that he is conning his audience for money. And the question is, can you take the premise, yes, the world is full of con artists, and say, ah, and you, the audience of Alex Jones, have just been duped by a really big one. Here is evidence in his own voice and in environments in which he does not dispute the counter evidence that admits that that's the case.
Yeah, that is Kathleen Hall-Jamison, who joined us along with Hilde Vandenbulk and Dolores Albarracin. We are talking about conspiracy theories, people who believe conspiracies, the power that they have to shape our culture, our politics. We got a lot of people, and I've been ignoring them, and I want to get these comments in on the conversation after this very short break. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with our guests about conspiracy theories, what drives them, who believes them, the impact that they have on our country, our culture, our politics. And again, our guests are Dolores Albarracin and Kathleen Hall-Jamison, co-authors with several other writers of a new book called Creating Conspiracy Beliefs, How Our Thoughts Are Shaped. Also with us, Hilde Vandenbulk, and she's a professor of communication at Drexel University. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Chris, who says, conspiracy theories are the tool of fascism. What would have happened if Hitler had had the internet? George says, when speaking, the reason Americans believe lies, we should be honest and say right-wing media. Bill says, people like conspiracies for the same reason they like popular fiction and religion. They are self-contained realms in which all is explained in ways that most people can understand, and everything happens for a reason. Even when conspiracies are about bad things, having them explained is comforting. Kathleen, do you want to respond? And we've been talking about this during the break, but do you want to respond to Bill's comment there, which is there's a certain pleasure and enjoyment in believing some of this stuff.
Yes, and those comments from your listeners are so smart. There's a sense of orderliness to a world in which you can explain everything from a few basic premises. And when you're deep inside a conspiratorial world, you have an explanation for just about everything because you've got malign actors whom you've already identified who are pulling strings of power in ways that are ordinarily beyond any reasonable expectation of their capacities. But nonetheless, it gives you the comfort of knowing that at least you know how it's working.
Yeah. Well, here's a listener tweet. Let me toss this to our two guests here in our studio, who says, once you get into a conspiracy circle, you're part of a group that shares something. If you ever see the truth, you lose your community and your friends, and you are back alone. Hilde, do you want to respond to that? I mean, that you're part of a group. You're connected.
I think so. It's almost like, in that sense, maybe like when if you're in a religious community, you also have, if people try to leave their religion, they lose their friends, right, in a way. So I think that is certainly also part of it. And I think I was interested by one of the comments to maybe a sort of media historical perspective also. What if Hitler had had the internet? Yeah. Hitler had the media of his time, and I don't know if it could have gotten much worse than how that ended up. So I think in that sense, I think, for instance, social media. I mean, if I'm the only person believing that the earth is flat in a very isolated community, I'm that one unusual person. On the internet, I find others and I build my community maybe. So I think social media could have done that in a certain way. They were also used smartly or are used smartly by those who want to spread the community. But, you know, the Nazis had their own media to spread their ideologies. The agitprop trains went through Russia to spread the message through films. I think in that sense, every message that needs to be spread will find the media that will help it. I think social media are more interactive probably compared to more traditional mass media, which was more sending out the message. But then again, even there, it was, people then talk to their peers about it and their relate and build the community there. You can exchange leaflets. So it's maybe a little too easy to say it's all the terrible social media or the internet. I think he did pretty damn things without the internet, right? So I think that's kind of the historical perspective, that they will always use the kind of media or the media that are there at the time.
And Dolores, I'm just thinking too about just, we all want to feel connected to something or connected to other people, and people of often like-minded beliefs makes us feel secure in the world.
Right, this is true. I mean, there is a fundamental need to belong that human beings have, and this is it's been posed as a very likely predisposition to believing in these ideas. But at the same time, the contribution of that is somewhat limited. There is a complexity of factors. Having said that, if it is true, then that's the case. How are we going to solve this? You need some kind of 12-step group to sort of retrain and re-socialize in a new idea. And if the ideas are addictive in some way or give you pleasure, then those would be the mechanisms. Yeah. Something that's intense involvement, re-socialized, and that's might tricky. Need that for, a large population.
Let me read an email from Amber. Can you talk about the fact that some of the conspiracies have a small amount of truth in them, and by making the story so overblown, the actual story gets buried? For example, Jeffrey Epstein was sex trafficking with very powerful people. But because the story became about lizard people and a pizza place, no one is talking about the people who were hanging out with Epstein and these young women. That is a very real story, and no one seems to want to talk about it. I mean, I think the Jeffrey Epstein story has been covered and talked about. We've talked about it on Radio Times, but I get your point, Amber, which is this sort of grain of truth, and then Kathleen connecting the dots between these, powerful people.
Yeah, and you've got one more piece, which is there usually is something that anchors these in some part of the external world, but there also is at least one or two instances somebody can readily go to in which there really was a conspiracy, where people denied there was a conspiracy, and it actually proved out. And so you put those little points of reality inside this broader structure, and now it seems to be anchoring in a way that increases the likelihood that when you scaffold all this other stuff around it, people think it's plausible.
Well, in fact, you write about the Pizzagate. I don't even know what to call it. It's so insane. But this idea that Democrats and Hillary Clinton in particular were sex trafficking children out of the basement of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. Kathleen, you and your co-authors write about this. This guy, Edgar Madison Welch, he went there. He was armed. He wanted to rescue these children. They obviously were not there. He got arrested, spent some time. Does he still believe that this is happening? That there's that they're Democrat pedophiles who are sex trafficking children? Kathleen?
This speaks to Dolores's earlier point. When you live inside a self-sealing world in which nothing will falsify your basic premises, all you have to say if you're Welsh in that circumstance is either he was set up, or if you want to look at what happened to Welsh and he didn't find the children, there was no basement, there was no pedophilia, that this is in fact a false flag organization set up in order to discredit the real theory that it's actually happening, and the people who set him up are the people who are actually engaged in the pedophilia. So once you get inside that world, there's no such thing as disconfirming evidence.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Let me just do a quick segue to the January 6th committee holding, obviously, hearings about the lies that led up to the insurrection against the U.S. Capitol. And perhaps, Hilde, I'll turn first to you. We've had weeks or days of evidence, largely from Republicans, which I thought was an interesting choice on the part of the committee, basically undermining this idea that there was election fraud and the election was stolen. Is that an effective way to deal with conspiracy theories?
I think the committee says very often, right, we want to sort of overflow fiction with facts. That's what they're trying to do. And they try to reach the hardest to reach audience. I mean, reaching people who were already upset by the January 6th, they are still appalled listening by hearing all the details, but they really want to reach those people that believe in the fiction, right?
Yes.
And I think that they do. Now, what was interesting was, I think at some point they had someone, and I'm not entirely, but someone who was part of sort of storming, and they asked him, and he said, well, I felt like I was living in a little, you know, that I had, blinders on. And was living in my own little world, doing my own research and thinking. And then I think someone asked him, how do you get out of it? He said, well, I did stop following those stories. And so he sort of created the idea that if you just stay away from all the social media, I think that's not really the thing. I think what also happened to him was he lost his job. He lost many things. I think it was a very harsh wake-up call that also helped there. I do think, and I think maybe the fact that eventually Fox News did broadcast them does show maybe some evolution in that they are breaking a little bit through with the facts also to those who do not want to hear the facts. But it seems to be a very slow process. And, you know, as I said, more than 500,000 turned away when Fox finally broadcast it. So there's sort of cognitive dissonance, sort of avoidance of whatever doesn't fit. So it's a long route, I think.
Here's another comment, an email from Stu Dolores. I'll put this to you. Don't say fear when it is hate. Anxiety is often caused by ignorance. And then he says language matters. So is anxiety and ignorance, do they go hand in hand from your perspective?
Well,
or hate. We'll throw hate in there as well.
To some extent, anger, which is what we've studied, doesn't correlate with these theories in the same way anxiety does. So, yes, it's plausible, but it's not what we find. And yes, ignorance, of course, lack or lower educational level correlates with being more anxious about lots of things because you have just fewer tools to deal with problems. So. Yes, but in the end, the sort of most immediate factor is anxiety. It's not education. Education only has an effect because it directs your sources of information, first of all, and second, because it gives you, it makes you less well-equipped to deal with issues and therefore more anxious.
I don't know anyone today who isn't anxious. I mean, to be honest with you, just because we live in I guess we've always lived in a world where there's been pestilence and disease and war and crisis. But maybe because of the media, it feels so immediate and so sort of crushing and ever-present, Dolores.
Right, COVID, inflation.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's a long list.
War.
Yeah. Kathleen, that anxiety is pervasive. I mean, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and I remember being worried about the atom bomb and hiding them under my desk in school. So it's not like this is new, but it does feel as if it's omnipresent.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons that I believe we're seeing news fatigue. because the way in which we're experiencing this is in most part not directly. Rather, we're experiencing it through our media exposure. And so as you see people say, I just can't take any more bad news, one of the responses of some is to consume less news. Mm-hmm. And the question is, in that kind of an environment, how do we continue to ensure that important information about legitimate threats about which you need to do something, and if you do something, you are protecting yourself, how are we going to make sure that that gets through? Yeah. And I'm thinking in particular right now about making sure that people understand that monkeypox is there. It can be transmitted through close skin-to-skin contact, but it also can be transmitted through clothing, bedding, and other items that have come in contact with somebody who's got monkeypox. We need that information to be available to people, and we need to let people know which communities are at risk, men who have sex with men in particular at risk, bisexual men particular at risk, and they ought to be trying to get to vaccination as quickly as we reasonably can get vaccination. Now, that's important consequential information, and if people turn away from news because there's just so much bad news being trafficked in media, mm-hmm. they might not get the information they actually need to protect themselves from a real risk or accurately characterize a risk that they have in relation to other risks.
Well, and I mean, we actually did a show about this yesterday. That can also lead to homophobia. You know, I mean, that it's nothing, you know, nothing seems to be simple and straightforward. Hilde, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, no, I can only confirm that it's, yeah, it is all pretty complicated, right? And I think maybe one other point that I was thinking, something we said earlier, is also maybe something to do with trust in institutions, right? But people are anxious, but people also feel that they, you know, if you go back to not understanding the world, and even like with vaccines, it's very interesting that there's nothing wrong with being a little critical about what is the next vaccine, particularly if sure. it comes at a high speed, right? But it is because people also have stopped trusting science, have stopped trusting government, have maybe stopped trusting the representatives of, you know, the sort of the federal, you know, medical experts that people that I think that also feeds in. And that is the same as that we need to work on education from a very low level. I think rebuilding trust in institutions means that these institutions need to do their best.
They need to do a good job.
Exactly.
Right? So they can
right?
be trustworthy.
Yes.
Yeah. Dolores, you want to add to that?
Yes, I agree with this, and at the same time, people need to be critical with any information they receive. And if they stop to be critical, that's when they become victims of all these possible deceptions. So we need both, you know, a sort of healthy level of trust while we have the ability to be critical and think in a, you know, well-formulated way, or think about the scientific process to understand why, you know, a particular theory about, you know, the coronavirus being a bioweapon just doesn't make sense.
Right.
Without that critical ability, I think we have issues too.
Well, we could do a whole hour on this. I mean, I think our science understanding is very limited in this country. I mean, I'm sure you would agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's limited, and it's limited especially when it comes to the process. It's a process of thinking and reaching conclusions and vetting evidence, and that has to be taught very well in a hands-on way from the very beginning, with those principles being pretty much set for life. If we had that, we would have a lot less trouble getting people to vaccinate. But if you have no understanding of what a virus is or how science works, then, of course, anything is equally plausible.
Kathleen Hall Jemison, I'm giving you the last 30 seconds. Final thought.
When in doubt, check it out, but determine who's trustworthy in your environment. And make sure that trust is continues to be merited as you scan broadly across all forms of mainstream news, because that's where you're most likely to get good health information in the moment when it's needed.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Kathleen Hall Jemison, thank you very much, as always.
You're welcome.
And she is director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, co-author of this new book, Creating Conspiracy Beliefs, subtitled How Our Thoughts Are Shaped. And she also wrote that with our other guest, Dolores Albarracin, and she is the director of the Science of Science Communication Division of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. And Dolores, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests, Hilde Vandenbulk, and she's a professor of communication at Drexel University. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to WHYY.org. Look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of this and all of our shows pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.